Wednesday here on the Mighty 690 at 7:41. That means it's time for our Green Setup program brought to you by Green Acres. And joining us from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District, we have Jesse Gilmore, horticulture agent. How are you doing, sir?
I'm cold.
Yeah, it is a chilly morning. 27, that'll do it. And I bet there are some plants that are cold right now, too. And if they weren't covered last night, well, there might not be green anymore.
Yeah, the problem we have this year is that it was so incredibly warm near the beginning of February that plants kind of snapped out of their dormancy early, and now we're getting back down into the cold. And I take full responsibility for that. I took the ice scraper out of my work truck, and of course, as soon as I do, that's when the cold temperatures roll back in. But there are some ways that you can protect plants from cold temperatures, kind of these late cold temperatures. There are some things to know about the cold and kind of what to expect from year on year. So our average last frost date in southeast Kansas and kind of, I'm assuming northeast Oklahoma as well, is April 15th. So about half of the years you can expect a frost after April 15th, and about half of the years your last frost will be before April 15th. And so that's a good date to plan around in terms of more tender plants to make sure that you are not potentially exposing them to cold injury. When we talk about something being tender, it's just that it can't take prolonged periods of cold. So one of the not most common plants, but one of the first plants that people think of when they think of tender is citrus. Citrus trees, lemons, oranges, most citrus are not going to be able to take temperatures below freezing, and so you're going to have to protect them. The kumquat is the exception. Kumquats can actually take 15-degree weather for an hour or two, so they are the most cold-hardy citrus, and I'd love to see more people try and grow them. But when you have a tender plant, you've got a couple of options. You can either protect the plants while they're outside, or I think personally the easiest option is to just put them in containers and to bring them inside during cold snaps. But you do have some protection options as well. You could drape tarps over the plants in order to keep some of the water vapor that's in the air and condenses on, for example, typically you're going to see frost on vehicles in periods when there's a lot of water vapor in the air, because then it will condense on the glass of your vehicle and then freeze that way. Same thing pretty much happens to plants as well. The more water vapors in the air, the more likely you're going to be to have a frost or a freeze on the plant. So you definitely want to cover tender plants, especially bigger plants that cost a lot of money to invest in, like fruit trees, for example, with some kind of tarp or fabric blanket. Typically, I believe the recommendation is you want to avoid fabric for more plastic tarps, because that fabric can actually absorb some of the moisture out of the air and cause the same chilling problem as just being exposed to the open. If you have plants that are in the ground and not in containers, you can recycle. One of my favorite things to do is recycle 2-gallon milk jugs, cut them in half, and you've got a makeshift cloche. Cloches historically were made of glass. They're just something you put over a plant to cover it. Typically they were used indoors, but there's not really a need to protect those plants compared to outdoor plants. So you just saw a 2-gallon milk jug in half horizontally. You do want to make sure you don't leave them on the plants all day, because they can get pretty hot if they are not vented. So the top half of the milk jug, you know, you've got the hole where you pour the milk out of, that's okay to leave on. But the bottom half, if you flip it over and you just put it on top of plants, there's no way for the heat to vent out, and it can scorch the plants if it's there for too long. A lot of people don't realize how good sunlight is at heating things up.
Oh, yeah.
So when you have a plant on the south side of a house that gets a lot of sun, you're going to get a lot of reflected heat off of your house in the summer or in the winter, because the sun is more southerly in the sky. So plants on the north side of the house, they're not going to get a ton of sun in the winter. The north side is always where you want to put more cold-tolerant plants. The south side of the house, that manipulates what's known as the microclimate. So with a little bit of finessing of the microclimate, you can grow plants that are typically thought of as a little more tender than what we can actually grow. And we just got bumped up to zone 7 hardiness zone from 6... yeah, excuse me. From zone 6B. So that means we are now... I want to say our minimum average temperature during the winter is between 5 and 10 degrees. So that is the average lowest temperature you can expect during the year. And just like average last frost date, half of the years we're going to have a low temperature, our lowest temperature of the winter, lower than 5 degrees. And half of the years our lowest temperature during the winter is going to be above 5 degrees. And that's important for figuring out if your woody plants, if your perennials are going to survive that cold snap. But, like I mentioned, there are things you can do. You just need to keep in mind the extra management that it's going to take to try and grow more tender plants.
Now, you mentioned earlier about some citrus and fruit trees and that sort of thing. I know that I've seen before maybe someone had a small orchard use those smudge pots that you light and to try to increase the air temperature a little bit. How well do those work?
I honestly have never heard of anyone using those. So it sounds like they're using... fire?
They're called smudge pots, or they probably have a different name, but basically they from what they said is they're these little kind of round things, or they have more modern versions that stand upright a little bit more, but basically they have a flame that'll, you know, just wick off. I don't know if they use kerosene or what they run off of, but they'll place them around the orchard, and I guess those can apparently raise the temperature 1 or 2 degrees just in that very, very isolated area. So I guess the thought being that if there is going to be something that's close to freezing, you can, especially maybe if you're around you can basically help those citrus trees.
Possibly.
You're around a critical time.
The one thing you do have to be mindful of when burning something is that it's going to release ethylene as a byproduct. And ethylene is a plant hormone that speeds up kind of the biological clock of the plant. So one of my favorite questions that I have ever answered on the job was getting called out to an Amish greenhouse after that huge freeze and polar vortex. And oh gosh, was that 2021 now?
Three years ago. Yep.
Man, time flies. But he called me out because some of the plants in his greenhouse were showing problems. And this was about the beginning of April in 2021. And so I kind of walked through the standard question and answer checklist for determining what the problem could be. And one of the things that I noticed in his high tunnel is that the plants that were right under the heat vent were showing the most problems. And it was also kind of distributed randomly through the greenhouse, but that was the only geographic pattern of plants that were showing issues in the greenhouse. And so I asked him, you know, how long have you been growing these tomatoes for? And he said, basically since the beginning of the year. And I'm like, what did you do during the polar vortex? And he's like, I was running my heat 24/7. And what we determined was that actually the heating system was not venting the exhaust properly. And so the plants that were closest to the vent, where all of this heat and these ethylene gases were coming in, were basically being ethylene gassed to death. So that is definitely something to keep in mind if you are burning anything near a plant. When you are doing that to a fruit tree, I assume you are trying to heat up the air around the plant enough because you are getting blossoms. If you have a late frost or freeze and the plant is already budding or blossoming, if those flowers are exposed to enough cold, you're not going to get any fruit for that year. And so typically what you're describing is likely going to be done by commercial orchards rather than homeowners.
Sure. Yeah. This in the case that I saw, this was around the Manhattan area, and the it was a professor who had some, basically, you know, a small orchard, maybe 20 trees, something like that. But yeah, he did have it set up to where he could do that if he had to, like around that kind of critical time if that happened. I think it was around that blossoming time or whatever.
Right, and that's why selection of specific varieties is so important, because varieties of trees, fruit trees, they're going to have a slightly different flowering time from variety to variety, and picking the right type of tree is also very important for minimizing losses from weather. So, you know, for example, you'd probably want to avoid apricot trees because they flower very early. Mm. I would say they have probably already flowered by now, especially with how warm it was in February. It was 2 years ago now, I was called out to a house in Independence to kind of walk through their landscape because they had just bought the house and they weren't sure what they had. And we found this tree with tiny fruits on it that looked like peaches. It was an apricot tree. It had already fruited that year.
Oh, my.
Yeah, it was... And I was surprised we had had fruit, because that was a particularly cold winter. So, yeah, kind of a miracle of apricot production there. I kind of wish I had gotten some pits to propagate the tree a little bit. But, you know, peaches, they're kind of notorious for early flowering, depending on the variety. So you want to do your research onto varieties for that. To make sure you're getting later fruiting varieties, because Kansas weather is notoriously unpredictable. Apples, cherries, plums, and pears, typically you're not going to have a ton of early flowering compared to peaches and nectarines and apricots. So variety selection matters a little less for that in terms of climate. So you'd want to pick varieties that are more drought tolerant, and varieties that are also disease resistant, because there are certain diseases that we have.
What about folks who are starting some of these plants indoors? I know that once you there's kind of a hardening off process that you want to accomplish before you actually get those plants outside. You don't just want to dump them outside and, well, good luck, guys.
Yeah, so that's where protection comes in a little bit for these plants if you get them out into the garden. Typically, you're not really going to be wanting to plant woody plants in the spring. That's more of a fall thing. Because the warm temperatures of the soil from the summer are going to help encourage root growth,
okay,
which you're not going to get, especially right now with how cold it is outside. So you could plant woody plants in the spring if you really wanted to, but there's a lot of reasons why fall, like around the September area, is a better time to do it. Less weed pressure, usually cooling temperatures, but still decently warm. You don't run the risk of accidentally letting your hose freeze on the spigot outside if you leave the hose out and we get a sudden cold snap, which if you have a hose out right now, I would definitely recommend draining it so that you don't get any burst hoses. But perennials are typically what you're going to be planting right now, or planting soon.
Mm-hmm.
And hardening off is definitely important. If you have a plant that is cold tolerant, you don't necessarily need to harden it off. You would want to harden off plants that are more tender, and a little bit of protection goes a long way. Like I mentioned, even the makeshift cloches that you have, I think I'm pronouncing that right, that you make out of the 2-gallon milk jugs, they can get decently hot. So you don't necessarily need to leave them on the entire time. Potentially leave them on at night, take them off during the day, and that should get you enough protection from cold. One other option that you have is to build yourself a makeshift cold frame, which is nothing more than a protection mostly from wind that you build. One of my favorite DIY setups is just out of reclaimed wood with an angled spare window or door with glass on it. It's basically a makeshift greenhouse. But it is not nearly as sealed as greenhouses are. So you still get enough exposure to the cold, but you want it angled, especially if it's on the south side of the house, to let as much of that sun in as possible. And you also want to hinge the door or the window on top so that you can prop it open to vent. Because letting the heat out is also very important. You don't want to overstimulate the plant with too much heat.
Yeah.
Because that's why we're seeing some of the problems we're seeing right now is they got overstimulated by the heat earlier. Oh, man, what was the highest temperature we had? Was it in the 80s?
We've made it through past the 80s. Yeah,
yeah, so yeah. Plants are definitely not used to seeing 80s in February.
Yeah.
And so...
Yeah, low 80s, I think, is the...
They snapped out of their dormancy. They got tricked. And now we're having to scramble back to protecting our plants for the spring frosts.
We're talking with Jesse Gilmore here from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. And Jesse, we're going to have you on for our second segment. And what do you plan to talk about then?
We're going to talk specifically about fruit trees. I've got a homesteading program coming up tomorrow evening at the Girard Public Library on fruit tree selection and maintenance. So I'm just going to go over some of the main points to think about if you're interested in planting fruit trees at your house.
Okay, well, stay tuned for that right here on the Mighty 690 as the Greenside Up program continues here on KGGF. We have all of 27 degrees right now and heading up to a high right around 54 for Coffeyville and Independence. We'll have a check of the news from Fox News and our local news, and then we'll be right back to our chat with K-State Research and Extension. 27 degrees right now in Coffeyville. Back here on the Mighty 690 at 810, we continue our Green Setup program brought to you by Green Acres. And back in studio with us, we have Jesse Gilmore once again, our horticulture agent for the Wildcat District. Good morning once again, Jesse.
Good morning.
So we are here on a bit of a chilly morning. You know, I don't know if it's unexpected cold snap. It just kind of is how it goes. Hopefully it's the last one. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see. It might be. The groundhog did, you know, he didn't see his shadow, so we're supposed to have an early spring. Yeah, but anyway, you know, talking, we mentioned woody plants and that sort of thing this last segment. And I know you want to talk just a little bit about fruit trees because you do have a talk that's coming up as part of the homesteading series.
Yep, our homesteading series class is tomorrow night in Girard at the Girard Public Library. I'm going to be talking about fruit tree selection and maintenance. So that has to do with, you know, what types of tree you grow, what varieties of that type of tree you grow, how you prune the trees in order to keep them healthy, and some ways to get them started off on the right foot. So most of my recommendations when it comes to what fruit trees to grow come from my own personal experiences coming out and looking at people's trees. So the less times that I get called out to look at specific trees, the better they are probably going to do. And so I get called out to a lot of peach trees and a lot of apple trees. Those are definitely the fruit trees that are going to need the most work, but they're also the fruit trees that I think most people try to grow around here. You see a lot of peaches, a decent amount of apples, and not very many plums or pears, which is unfortunate because those are the two best adapted fruit tree types for our area, especially pears. Plums, I attribute the lack of planting to probably the complexity of determining which plum is the right plum to grow. There's European plums, there's American plums, there's Japanese plums or Asian plums, and they all have a little bit different of a climate need and maintenance. So that adds a little bit of complexity to the fruit tree orchard planning stage. Peaches, you can have either freestone or clingstone. Freestone means that the pit is going to separate from the flesh much easier than clingstone will. Usually it can't, and most freestone, they can just fall right out of the fruit if you cut the peach in half. Typically freestone are going to be a little bit more touchy with environmental needs. And they're also going to bloom a little bit earlier. We talked in the first half of the program about bloom time and how you need to get a fruit tree that blooms as late as possible in order to minimize the chance that your flowers are caught by an early freeze, a late freeze, or a late frost, because those flowers are crucial to getting any fruit. If you don't have the flowers, if the flowers die off early, there's going to be nothing for bees to pollinate, which means that there's going to be no fruit production. So definitely want to go with clingstone if you are looking for a specific peach variety. Nectarines are the same as far as freestone and clingstone go. They are a little bit less environmentally touchy than peaches are, but I have not seen a single person try and grow nectarines just because of the familiarity of peaches over nectarines. Now, I would love to see people try growing fruit if they really are interested in it, but I would recommend people shy away from peaches overall because of how much spraying they need for chemicals in order to have a marketable fruit. It's very hard to get a clean crop of peaches with all of the insect pressure that we have.
Oh, yeah.
Disease pressure as well, specifically with brown rot. So if you are dedicated to lots of peaches and lots of work for peaches, I would say go ahead and try it. We do have a publication, and off the top of my head, I don't remember the varieties we recommend the most. Peaches are not one of those fruits that are self-pollinating, so you will need two different varieties of peaches in order to get fruit. When we talk about self-pollinating, typically what you're going to have, a lot of people ask about self-pollinating because they just have room for one or two trees, and they want to know if they can just plant, you know, one apple and one pear, and you'll get apples and you'll get pears. A lot of fruit is self-pollinating, but you are always, and this is 100% true across the board with any fruiting plant, going to get better production if you can have multiple varieties because of the genetic diversity that you're introducing. So cross-pollination will always get you a better yield. Sometimes that is kind of a burden. So on pears, you're going to have to thin out a crop usually. When you have peaches, for example, I've been called out a couple of times by people freaked out about all of the fruit falling off of the tree. And that's actually natural. It's called the June drop. It is the tree's way of thinning out the fruit in order to have higher quality fruit left over.
That's cool.
And so it's nice because you don't have to thin the fruit yourself. But with all other fruits, you're going to have to do that. And with pears in particular, my stepdad is often fond of telling me how he used to do it with his pear trees. He would actually pull the flowers off at a certain spacing, usually about 6 inches on the branch, and have one flower every 6 inches.
Oh, okay.
So it's a lot easier to do that with flowers than it is to do it with the fruit once it starts developing.
Now, are these going to be pollinated by cross-pollinated by wind and everything, or do we rely on bees or, you know, insects?
There are very, very few plants that are cross-pollinated by wind. Corn is one example. The tassels are actually the flowers on corn, and the pollen they release is so fine that wind can cross-pollinate. Same with spinach. The pollen on those flowers is so fine that it can be carried for up to 2 miles by wind. Wind, not very common as far as pollination goes. Flies, the only fruiting plant I can think of that's pollinated by flies is the pawpaw, and you're not really going to see that commercially produced.
Nope.
Although they did ask about that for the first time on the Ag Census in 2022, so it seems to be more common than it used to be in terms of commercial production. But the vast majority of pollination is going to be done by bees and, to a lesser extent, butterflies and moths.
And the bees are out. I mean, I've noticed them a lot already.
Oh, yeah. Warm period back in February. I think that's what Punxsutawney Phil meant when he said early spring, literally in February, and then he never said how long it would last. I'm not going to hold it against him. But yes, bees are going to do the lion's share of the pollination. So you definitely want to be sure if you are spraying that you do not spray, especially insecticides, around the time when your fruit tree would be flowering. Most insect pests are not going to be active at that point anyway, so you're going to be doing a lot more harm to your potential pollinators than you will control insect pests like the coddling moth or the oriental fruit moth, which are the two primary pests of most fruits. You get down into the... I'll come back to pest management if we have time at the end. Selecting fruit trees. Plums and pears, those are the two fruits that I see be the most productive for the least amount of work. Specifically with plums, they're going to be the European type and not necessarily the American type. There is a big difference between American and European plums. When you think European, that's going to be the type that you buy at the grocery store, or at least you look at the grocery store. I don't see a ton of people buying plums at the grocery store. But those are going to be your large peach-sized, apple-sized fruits. American plums are much, much smaller. There's a lot of different species of plums native to the Americas. Most of them are not going to be any bigger than a ping pong ball. So they are a very different type of fruit, I would say just as productive, but you have to find a good way to use them compared to eating raw, which most European plums you're gonna be able to eat raw. Japanese plums, a little less adapted, but gaining interest in terms of fruit that you can grow. I have not seen anyone growing Japanese plums in our area. So that would be worth trying. You just got to make sure that you do your research and get the right variety. As far as diseases go, there's not really a ton of diseases for plums that you need to select against. The only one I can think of would be brown rot, and that's a generalist that you're going to have to deal with in any fruit tree, not just plums. So it's not something really unique to plums that you'd have to deal with. There are some insects that you'd have to deal with, plum curculio, but again, that's a generalist. If there's no plums, they will go after other fruits like peaches and apples. Pears, I have not seen any insect problems with pears at all. It's fascinating how they avoid pears for literally any other type of fruit. The only disease that I would recommend watching out for is fire blight, and that's true with apples as well. Fire blight will kill off trees completely, so you need a resistant variety ahead of time when you are buying the fruit tree, so you're not dealing with it every year. It's very hard to get rid of fire blight once you have it. And a reminder, resistance is not the same thing as immunity. So if you have a plant that says it's resistant to a disease, but it's being stressed out by other external factors, that disease can still hit your tree, probably to a lesser extent, but you pile all of these stresses on each other and something's going to break eventually. And typically that is going to be disease resistance. So even, for example, Dutch elm disease resistant elms like Valley Forge or Princeton, if there's enough environmental stress, which there has been the last couple of years, you start seeing Dutch elm disease in these resistant varieties. The resistance is just there to inhibit the growth of this disease or the spread of this disease in optimal conditions. And the farther back or the farther away from optimal conditions you get, the more likely the disease is going to take hold. So it will take a little bit of management, even with the most resistant varieties, to make sure that, you know, it's getting enough water in the summer when we are in drought periods. The pruning is done correctly and the any problematic parts of the tree are pruned out. Luckily, fruiting pears like Bartlett, they're going to be much stronger in terms of wood than ornamental pears will be. You definitely want to strongly consider cutting out ornamental pears. And I see a lot of people on Facebook very sad because the flowers look very pretty for 2 weeks.
And then they smell.
Well, they smell even when they're flowering. I think they smell like fish, but, you know, you ask 100 people what a fruiting or a flowering pear, a ornamental pear smells like, and you'll get 100 different answers. There are better native species to plant in terms of nice looking white flowers, typically dogwoods. But, you know, a lot of people like their ornamental pears. They are a very handsome tree.
Yeah, we got the red buds if you want some.
Oh, red buds look great, but probably a little bit of an ornament, different ornamental niche compared to ornamental pears. But, yeah, fruiting pears, much stronger wood. You're not going to see as much limb breakage, assuming that you are doing the proper pruning compared to ornamental pears. Apples kind of fall in the middle ground between peaches and plums and pears when it comes to management. You are going to need to do a decent amount of spraying, but not necessarily to the point where you're, you know, spraying peaches. And there's not really many diseases or insects that would completely kill off an apple tree compared to a peach tree. It is also susceptible to fire blight. And one thing I forgot to mention about pears, and I'm going to bring it up now that we're talking about apples as well, you want to be careful planting them around cedar and juniper species because of cedar apple rust and cedar hawthorn rust. Both of those diseases are a two-host system where the plant fruits on the cedar tree, and oftentimes those galls that it creates will look very, very bizarre, kind of almost jelly-like and orange, very bright orange. Usually whenever you have a rust, you're going to have an orange color. And the spores will spread from that fruiting body on the cedar to the pear or the apple tree. And while the disease is not destructive to cedar trees, it is destructive to apple and pear trees. So that is definitely something to keep an eye out for, potentially something you will have to spray for.
Now, when we are spraying for these things, I mean, are you using just like a normal kind of hand sprayer? I mean, do you have to get the whole tree? I mean, how does that work?
You would want to get as much of the tree as you possibly can. And that's one reason why a lot of people tend towards dwarf trees of fruit. When we say dwarf, we mean dwarf compared to the standard size of that particular species. People get dwarf pecan trees and wonder why their pecans are 35 feet tall and wide. It is because standard pecans will grow up to 80 feet tall and wide, and sometimes even higher with the right environmental conditions. So you have to compare it against the standard for that species. But dwarf fruit trees, typically that's going to be a dwarfing rootstock. And so your above ground portion or your upper portion of the tree is going to be a specific variety that you want for some kind of yield characteristic. So it's a heavy producer, it is a variety you enjoy, or it is a variety that has some kind of appeal in a market. And the rootstock is going to give you your size, your disease and insect resistances. It's going to give you most of the, as the plant is growing, characteristics. Apples, I think, are very popular because they are so understandable. Like, almost everyone knows how to use apples.
Yeah.
And they usually have a specific variety. Like, if you asked the average person out on the street, what's your favorite variety
they
of
would
plum?
Know. Yeah, they would, for apples, they would know.
For apples, they
Not
would
for
know.
Plums.
For plums, pears, and probably even peaches, they would
know.
It's definitely the most understandable of the variety selection. And the Purdue University has a very good publication of about 200 different varieties of apples and their relative resistances to four primary diseases. So powdery mildew, the rusts, so cedar apple rust, apple scab, and fire blight. Hmm. And the two that you need to watch out for are the fire blight and the rust.
Okay.
Apple scab is a little bit lesser.
Well, we're getting close to the end of our time today, Jesse, but is there still a chance for people to get and attend your upcoming workshop here with the trees or any of the other homesteading series?
Yeah, they would need to call Sherry at the Altamont office, pulling up the phone number real quick to make sure I give everyone the right number.
Sure.
But the Altamont office phone number is 620-784-5337. You just talk to Sherry and ask to sign up.
Excellent.
And if anyone wants to get in touch with me about fruit trees or really anything else horticulture related, they can call me at 620-724-8233, which is the Girard office, or they can email me at jr637@ksu.edu.
All right. Thank you, Jesse. Appreciate you coming on by. And coming up next, we are going to be getting into open line here on the Mighty 690 just after 835.